From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2019 in New York City, where an education policy group told then New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio to get rid of school gifted and talented programs. Some of the advocates for change were blunt. Gifted programs, they said, are racist. Here's how Manhattan Institute fellow and former chair of the Maryland State Board of Education, Andy Smerick, described it. Quote, an education panel convened by Bill de Blasio put New York City's mayor in a bind. It recommended dismantling much of the city's programming for gifted students in order to advance integration. De Blasio is known for his charged progressive rhetoric about ending inequality, but the proposal would compel him to stop talking and take on the thousands of families who like special academic offerings for their high-performing children. The panel argues in its report that the system serves to segregate by race, income, and language, and to perpetuate stereotypes about student potential and achievement. The panel would institute a moratorium on new gifted and talented programs, phase out existing programs, end the use of middle school entrance criteria such as grades, test scores, behavior, and lateness, and fundamentally alter high school admission practices. The panel would instead prioritize school-wide enrichment programs so a diverse student body could learn together under one roof. End quote. What was happening in New York City was happening in other cities and states, too. In 2021, David Frum wrote for The Atlantic that he considered the movement to be a war on gifted kids, marshaled by the progressive left. Frum wrote, quote, across the U.S., blue state educational authorities have turned hostile to academic testing in almost all of its forms. In recent months, honors programs have been eliminated in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Seattle. On Long Island, and in Pennsylvania and Virginia, curricula are being rethought to eliminate tracking that separates more and less adept student populations. New York City's specialist public high schools are under fierce pressure to revise or eliminate academic standards for admission. Boston's exam schools will apply different admission standards in different zip codes. San Francisco's famous Lowell High School has switched from academically selective admission to a lottery system. At least 1,000 colleges and universities have halted the use of the SAT, either permanently or as an experiment. End quote. I want to note here that we plan to address the question of SATs soon on this program. There is some evidence that colleges and universities are going back to SATs because it turns out that relying on other measures can be even more advantageous to wealthy and advantaged students. But back to gifted programs. When a local group reached out to us a few weeks back, at first, I confess that I hadn't read a lot about it. I kind of wondered about the optics. After all, it's hard to get much sympathy when you plead. But what about the gifted kids? Who will stand up for the gifted students? But the group assured me this is not only about boosting kids who already had all the advantages in life. This was about doing what's right for kids from all backgrounds, kids who excel at young ages, kids who might be bored if they're not pushed in ways that their peers might struggle with. And after all, as one parent said to me, the world has big problems to solve. Don't we want to challenge and prepare the highest achievers to solve those problems and not distract them or dispirit them about education? In the end, it's about whether schools can do both and provide the necessary resource for students who struggle and fall behind while offering a different path for kids who excel. Today, Jonathan Plucker is visiting the Rochester area from Johns Hopkins University. He's considered perhaps the foremost expert in the field of gifted education. Dr. Plucker works in the Center for Talented Youth at Johns Hopkins. He's the author of a number of books, including Critical Issues and Practices in Gifted Education. And he's one of our guests this hour on Connections. Dr. Plucker, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon.
And welcome to Nina DeVivo-Schaefer, who's co-chair of Pittsford PTSA Quest. First of all, hello. Thank you for being with us here.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us what PTSA Quest is in Pittsford.
PTSA Quest is the parent advocacy group for high ability learners in our district. But as I've continued on in this role, I've met people from many districts and other counties who have no such group. And so we're always open to including people from other districts so that they can find camaraderie and help. And
sounds like community. It's been kind of a coalition across districts.
It has been, yes.
Yeah. And I want to start by asking, first of all, if there's something you want the community to know about. You brought Dr. Plucker here to Rochester. What do you want listeners to know about his visit here?
Well, first, we're really grateful to Dr. Plucker. This is very much a grassroots effort. We've had many districts and parent groups come together to fundraise to make this all possible. He's been an incredible partner and very generous with his time. We had wanted to share this expert with the entire community. So today at 4 o'clock, he's doing a teacher professional development session at Cockins Road Middle School entitled Creativity in the Classroom. And then tonight at 7 o'clock, he's doing a parent and caregiver session for what it is, creativity, what it is, what it isn't, and how to help bright children have more of it. And because of the generosity of all of our sponsors, it's free and open to any teacher, any parent or caregiver who'd like to attend.
And again, what time and where?
The teacher session is 4 o'clock. The parent session is 7 p.m. And they're both at Cockins Road Middle School in Pittsburgh.
Dr. Plucker, I want to start by asking you to summarize the problem, I guess, in gifted education as you see it today.
It's a complex problem. You gave lots of really good examples of how we've really struggled with this. I think one thing we have to do is be very honest that the way we've done, you know, quote unquote, gifted education over the past 50, 60 years has not been very well designed and thoughtful. I'm in no way questioning the intentions of people who led these efforts, but I'd say over the past 15 years or so, we've just learned so much more about how to actually do this effectively and equitably. And so one of the biggest problems is that I just don't think many people realize how many of our students are capable of advanced learning. So we actually did this study a handful of years ago. What percentage of, say, grades 3 through 8 students would you estimate show up to the first day of school already knowing most of what's going to be taught this year? What would your guess on that percentage be?
What percentage show up in what grade?
Any grade. So let's say fourth graders who show up and they know everything that's going to be taught until fifth grade. What would you guess that percentage is?
5 to 10?
I would have guessed 15 before we did this study. The answer is over 25% in most school districts. So we actually have lots of students who are already performing at that advanced level, let alone all the others who may have the potential to do it. So part of it is we've just had this very sort of scarcity mindset about talented students, thinking, well, it's only a couple percentage of kids. It's not uncommon for me to go into school districts and I say, okay, how many bright students are you working with? And they go 1 to 2%. And I was like, I've already found your problem for you. like it is probably at least 10 to 15% higher than that. And it just blows their mind. Even if they have the test scores in front of them sometimes, they will still not just, it's really hard for people to believe. So New York City is a fantastic example of this, right? In that they have these selective high schools, but they serve such a small percentage of students in the nation's biggest school district. We've sort of created this artificial scarcity. And whenever you do that, equity becomes really, really difficult because there just aren't enough services. So if you had to boil it down to what the big problem has been and stuff that we've been learning about, it is this sort of scarcity mindset, which leads to just not offering enough advanced services for these students.
I want to read a little bit more from Smerick's 2019 piece now. He says, quote, instead of destroying the current system, the panels in New York City could, for instance, have suggested methods to improve the identification of gifted students or creative ways for the district to use federal Title I funds to support low-income gifted students. And they should have insisted that all students get the best possible primary school instruction so they are all equally able to compete for the limited spots in screened high schools there. The scholars Jonathan Plucker and Scott Peters have explored and recommended an array of interventions along these lines. End quote. Can you elaborate on how to do that? I mean, my read is that many of the opponents of gifted programs are genuinely concerned that it could be exclusive in a way that just further sort of entrenches advantage in pockets of students who already have a lot of advantages. So in other words, I think a lot of the opposition is at least well-intended or concerned about making sure if we're going to divide education this way that it really is for everybody and accessible for everybody. And can you describe what Smerick was describing here, how to do kind of the both and in this educational debate where it's like, is it for the collective or is it for individuals? How do you see it?
I mean, I should start off by saying that I don't question the critic's sincerity at all. In fact, I would say much of my career is based on responding to their thoughtful criticisms. I mean, they've got some very good points here. Gifted education, advanced education, defined sort of broadly, unquestionably, in some places at some times, has been used to segregate, for example. I think the things that we're learning now are just being about sort of managing the advantage that social capital gives you, which I know is very, very jargony, but it some people just know the system really well. They've been in through it themselves. They know the superintendent. They can walk into the principal's office. Lots of families don't have those advantages. They've never participated in special school services at all. They may be recent immigrants, and they come from a country where like things like gifted ed are just unheard of. So when you, for example, use sort of an old school identification strategy of having, say, parents nominate their students to be considered for these programs. Well, who's most likely to nominate their children? People who understand the system, right? And so lots of our strategies across the field have come from just trying to sort of manage that and really create a level playing field. The most important, unquestionably, is what we call universal screening, which is if you have advanced opportunities, the whole point is to try to find students who need more, to be very, very colloquial about it. Who needs more? More challenge, go through the material faster, etc. If you're going to do that, don't do it selectively. Look at every single student. And what we find is that universal screening, especially for low-income students, generally increases participation rates by 4 or 5-fold. It's a huge difference in helping find these students. So it's strategies like that, universal screening, looking in every single school and every single classroom for these students, because again, our studies tell us that they're there in every single classroom. Most people actually don't think that that's true. So it really is about fighting people's expectations.
And if I could, I think some of the critics might contend that, well, you can screen all students, but you're still going to end up with a skewed cohort because screenings, tests, evaluations have tended over time to benefit, you know, privileged or advantaged students. And I think part of what you're arguing is, tell me if I'm wrong here, that you can screen universally and it does identify students who need more, as you put it, from all backgrounds. It doesn't exactly just skew in one direction.
Yes. I mean, and there are certainly other strategies that we would use on top of that. So for example, we know that if you start with teacher nominations, you're essentially making teachers into gatekeepers, for lack of a better term. And lots of studies now have shown that that introduces lots of bias into the system. We all have our implicit biases, and we all have stereotypes about what a gifted child is. Most of those stereotypes are wrong. So whenever you're like sort of relying on one gatekeeper, you're going to run into problems. So we have found school districts that have flipped that around. They use universal screening at grades, test scores, whatever, to get that pool. Then they go to the teacher last, and they don't ask the teacher who needs more. They say, who needs more that we've missed with the universal screener? And it totally moves the teacher from the gatekeeper role into the safety net role. No one that I know went into education to be a gatekeeper. Most people I know went into education wanting to be a safety net, to just being smarter about using people's skills and motivations. I've never sat in one of those meetings and not had a teacher say, oh, you've missed this student, and here's why. And it's usually a very thoughtful reason. You know, they're just learning English, or you caught them on a bad day, or, you know, their mother's very, very sick. Teachers have this great information about students. Rather than putting them at the beginning, you put them at the end. We've been developing strategies like that to pair with universal screening. And a study after study keeps telling us now that that provides a much more diverse group of advanced students that tends to look like the general student population, which is what our goal is.
Well, can I ask Nina to describe a little bit of your own family story? I mean, part of why you were interested in Dr. Plucker coming is because of what you have experienced, and you want to describe a little bit of that?
Sure, thank you. Honestly, this was really led by one of my children. I had no agenda to get them into a certain program or label them as gifted or high ability. I basically had an elementary school child who was coming home day after day, who just, that love of learning, the love of reading and math was just deteriorating pretty quickly. And they were very quickly wanting to stop going to school. Sunday nights were awful because they knew what was coming, this long week ahead of sitting through classroom lessons that felt really slow because they pick things up really, really fast. And so a lot of the repetition, the worksheets, while certainly they have their place, I think for kids who learn new material very fast, can be a very difficult way to spend every day, every week, every month, potentially year after year. And so I'm a public school kid, and I'm a big fan of public schools. So to have a child coming home just filled with despair and frustration and disappointment was really hard as a parent to see this whole thing becoming a bust.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Were they using language like, I'm bored?
I was hearing that a lot.
Okay.
And I felt, you know, as an adult, I heard that and thought, you know, what are they expecting to be entertained? But
sure.
I knew
yeah.
that wasn't what they were trying to say, but that's how a third and fourth grader might say, or even an older child
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried not to get hung up on the language, and I would sort of delve deeper. And that's when I realized there was something else going on. So I started talking to the teacher, to other parents. I was calling gifted ed teachers and experts in our area, trying to understand what might be going on. And that's when I realized something had to change, or else we were never going to make it to the end of elementary school, much less high school graduation.
And what has happened since?
So thankfully, in our district, there is a gifted ed trained specialist at that elementary school. And although I didn't even know that they were there, but we did eventually get in touch with that person, who was wonderful. And, you know, they found ways to engage my child, and they were brought into it's like a pullout group where they would delve into higher level reading at a much deeper level and really struggle with challenging questions and have to write complicated responses that they had to wrestle with, which was a really great experience for my child because they hadn't been challenged like that. And one of my concerns was, at some point they will be challenged. Maybe it will be high school, but man, that's a long time to wait. And I didn't want them to fall on their face, maybe taking a calculus class or an AP class or something. I really wanted them to experience academic challenge and struggle and maybe even fail before they got to that high profile place when grades really matter and people worried about colleges seeing it. So I really wanted to keep that academic flame alive and keep them loving school, really.
And today? Better now?
Definitely better. I worked with a bunch of parents to advocate in a positive way with our school district. It took a couple years. We were at board meetings, but we have a wonderful relationship with the administration, and they heard us, and they did create an additional position at the middle school, which has been incredibly helpful for all the students there now. We're very grateful.
Dr. Plucker?
Yeah, I think that Nina's example is a great example of what you and I were talking about earlier, about the importance of having social capital. Nina and her friends and colleagues and fellow parents knew what to do, to go to board meetings, to go and talk to go and talk to the principal and teachers, et cetera. So many families don't know what to do in those situations. And that's why this artificial scarcity, again, causes such a problem. And it's one reason why I really strongly believe we have to have at least some level of like advanced academic services in every single school, so that it doesn't become who you know and, you know, can I find the time off to go to a school board meeting? There are a lot of families that can't do that. So it's very important to have it everywhere.
So let me ask a few questions that come to mind based on this. I appreciate Dr. Plucker bringing up families that maybe don't have the social capital or even the time or the capacity to recognize some of the steps that Nina and her family took. Because part of what I was thinking coming into this conversation was, you know, I've always thought of the idea of a parent's role in education as, at least this is just my limited view, and I'm not trying to speak for others, but there's no school that I can think of that has everything that I would want for my child. There's no school that's perfect, that has perfect extracurriculars, perfect academic challenge for him. I think a fair and representative and helpful and realistic look at what the world looks like, diversity in all kinds. So what you don't have in your school, I think as a parent, if you can try to fill those gaps when the child's not in school, that's great. I think part of what Dr. Plucker is saying is not every family is sort of thinking that way. And not every kid who would need to be pushed in certain ways or need more academically is going to have that opportunity. So I at least that's the way I took some of your comments. You're thinking about families that don't have that social capital advantage.
Yeah, I mean, and I would disagree slightly
okay. On
your example there. I totally agree. There's no perfect school, and you always have to be advocating for the things that you'd like to see in that school. But we're talking about learning,
mm-hmm.
and that just seems to me like, for most schools, making sure that every student is intellectually, academically challenged at the appropriate level is kind of the base of what we would expect to be there. So I don't see it as an extracurricular, for example, or an add-on that would be nice to have. It really does strike me as something that really should be there for everybody. And now let's say, go back 50, 60 years, students with special learning needs, parents had to really fight hard. We've made such huge strides in special education where it's much easier for them now. I just don't see why we can't then do that on the advanced side, or for students who are what we would call twice exceptional, who have both things that they're struggling with and really advanced skills. So it just feels like a baseline expectation to me.
Okay. And so the second part of the question that I have about if we actually see an expansion of academic offerings, because part of you just joining us, part of what Dr. Plucker is saying is schools have been sort of undercounting and under-recognizing a population of students who you might call gifted, whatever the label would be, and pretty significantly so. What I'm wondering is this. We know things are already competitive enough, especially when it comes to applying to college, et cetera. I'm thinking of Caitlin Flanagan's piece about independent schools a couple of years ago, where there's all of this pressure. Parents are paying $60,000 a year, and kids are getting, you know, starting at grade 4, grade 2. And the expectation is, well, there's a college degree on the end of this, and there's a chance to be an elite society. So if all of a sudden public schools have 20 to 25% of students kind of segmented into high achievers or gifted or whatever you would call it, does that immediately tell the higher ed institutions, well, that's where you're picking from, and the students in the general population are disadvantaged? Will they have less of a shot? Will the outcomes be imbalanced there? Is that a fair concern, Dr. Plucker?
It feels a bit like a red herring to me, to be absolutely honest. I mean, I totally get the logic there. There's so many ways to provide advanced services that don't segment students off. That's sort of an old school model for how we used to do this.
I'm definitely thinking of a 1990s mindset here.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And most people do when we have this conversation. It's very, very, very fair because you know the schools that you went through, right?
Yep.
And I'm a little older than to have gone through schools in the 1990s. So let's.
I bet you were close, Doctor. That's all right.
I don't think that's a concern. Can we emphasize excellence a bit too much in, say, sports, the arts, academics? Sure. Underemphasizing it so much at this point, that's a concern that I would love to have. I just don't see it anywhere, though. I really don't.
So can you describe what it looks like when K-12, public education, is it using a model that you think is a lot more effective? What does that look like?
Well, I think certainly anything that allows students to move more at their own pace is very, very helpful. And so we have certainly seen school districts where they take more of a talent scout model, and they're just always looking for evidence that a student, for example, is talented in math. It may be a test score, it may be a grade, it may be an offhand comment about how they love doing math puzzles at home. And as soon as teachers hear that, they just start to talk to each other about, you know, how can we give the student that more again? Maybe they need more advanced math. Maybe they need to do more enrichment with, you know, more complicated puzzles and things like that, just to see if there's some talent there. What we generally find is that most students love to be challenged. One reason why students don't like school is that they're not challenged when they should be, because they have these talents. None of us at any age wants to go someplace where we're not going to be challenged and we're going to sit around bored, right? And so we want it to be challenging. We want it to be interesting. You know, allowing students to move at their own pace really, really helps with that. There are lots of different ways to, you know, introduce acceleration into the average school experience for students. And they don't have to be radical things like grade skipping, which I would say is I wouldn't say the last resort, but for most students, probably close to it. When I was an elementary school teacher in this state, we used to, if there was a student who was very advanced in math, we would just bump them ahead in math just when they took math every day, right? So there are ways to do it that aren't very burdensome, that get more challenge into that curriculum without having to use that old-fashioned model of, oh, hey, you're going to go into a different school, you're going to go into a different room. It doesn't have to be that way anymore.
When we come back from our only break, I want to take a little bit of listener feedback, and I want to ask our guests how they see that landscape of K-12 education in particular in this country, if it is changing for Dr. Plucker fast enough, and for someone like Nina DeVivo Schaefer, who's with us, who is a parent and the co-chair of Pittsford PTSA Quest, what it means in New York State and how New York State views this question and how that might differ from other states. So we're going to take that break. We'll come back and welcome some more of your feedback on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Rochester Mayor Malik Evans joins us first hour. He's delivering his State of the City address, and we'll talk about the state of Rochester with Mayor Malik Evans. In our second hour, understanding ethical business practices and approaches. You might have heard the term B Corp. What is a B Corp? We'll talk about it Thursday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Ellie writes us today, it's not about giving gifted kids more work. They usually grasp the concepts easily. It's about going deeper and making them think laterally, creatively, differently, doing hard things when regular schoolwork comes so easily for them. That's from Ellie. What do you think, Dr. Plucker?
I would strongly, strongly agree. The only quibble I would have is that I would like us all to move away from using the term gifted. It just has so much historical baggage. When I have people come up to me and say, like, what's the difference between a bright student and a gifted student? I always sit there and think, I don't know. These are just terms. I just prefer advanced students and advanced education, because I think everybody knows what that means, and it doesn't have all the historical baggage that the G word does. But otherwise, I totally agree with everything she just said.
Well, I mean, on that subject, I was going to read Hope's email. I'll read it now. Hope says, I've got a problem with people labeling some children as gifted and talented, because it leaves the other kids labeled as not gifted and talented. I believe all kids are gifted and talented. They may be talented in different areas, but calling one student talented and the others not is not positive or supportive or kind. My child is in extended studies in Brighton and is considered gifted. The class that he is part of is project-based, hands-on, and uses real-life experience and scenarios. I believe every child can benefit from this kind of teaching and learning curriculum. Why isn't more of this kind of teaching used for everyone and more inclusively? Also, we know that the Montessori and Waldorf-based educational systems are better at supporting different learning styles of students and producing better and more creative thinkers. Why have those systems not been implemented in overall general K-12 education in the United States? That's from Hope. Dr. Plucker?
Second part of that question is a much longer discussion, I think. there's a lot of different questions there. I think one big issue that we have to be frank about is that teachers, principals, superintendents, future educators almost always receive no training in working with advanced students, like none. And then we put them into the classroom and we ask them to look for these students, help students who need more, and they just don't have strategies to do it because we've never taught them.
That's not part of teaching certificate program?
It is not.
Anywhere?
It is required, I believe, in 4 states. And the requirements are very, very soft. I think that to me, if we had to do one thing to help improve American education, would just be to give every single teacher, every single principal and superintendent at least some instruction in advanced learning so that they have these strategies to use whenever they need them. Maybe it's with a small group of students. Maybe they can use it with all their students. Just getting those skills into their hands, I think that's a major, major limitation.
Do you think Montessori and Waldorf have been shown to be good models that should be more adopted into mainstream K-12?
I don't know enough about Waldorf to comment, so I won't. Montessori, the research is generally positive in some ways and on certain types of skills. So I'm going to withhold judgment there.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much. And Nina, if you want to jump in at any of this point, I mean, I wonder how you feel about hearing Hope's email as a parent yourself.
There were a lot of layers to that email.
That is true.
I think there are many techniques that can be used with high ability learners, advanced learners, that can also be beautifully applied to, I think, all students. And I would wholeheartedly recommend that. At the same time, I think that all students have different needs, and I would love for all of those to be recognized and addressed appropriately. I see that as a sense of equity. I feel like, the core business, as Jonathan was saying, the core business of education is to teach and to educate. And I feel like that includes everybody, not just certain populations. And, I feel like to keep kids engaged and interested in school and trying to be their best, I feel like every child deserves to learn something new each day. I have no problem with my child being asked to go to the back of room and help tutor a child that's struggling. But I don't necessarily think it's quite right to have them doing that every day, all the time. And we have experienced some of that, as I know many people have. So I'm all for students helping each other out, but I do feel that kids who are advanced learners who have other needs, those will hopefully be addressed too.
Okay. Dr. Plucker?
I think that the pandemic really opened lots of parents' eyes to what their child's experience was in school. I had several friends and colleagues call me like two or three months into the pandemic and say, ugh, my, daughter or son's school is totally mishandling the pandemic, all this virtual instruction. I had one colleague who called and said, my daughter gets through all her work in 2 hours a day. This is ridiculous. Why aren't they teaching her like they normally do? And I just let that question hang out there for a minute. And then I said, how much do you think she actually learns new stuff in school every day? And there was a long pause. And he said, oh, son of a gun. Yeah, maybe this is what she normally learns. I'm like, yeah, the rest of the day is probably busy work for her because there's not any advanced instruction. They're not trying to give her more. They're not trying to challenge her more. They're giving her a bunch of extra worksheets. She's getting them really fast every day. And then the rest of the day, she's hanging out with her friends. And I think coming out of the pandemic, we've seen a lot more pressure, especially on sort of the parent side of things, going, wait, my student really isn't challenged all that much here. Is 2 hours a day really enough for them? I think most of us would say probably not for most kids.
All right, a lot of feedback. If you're on the phone or if you've emailed, I'm going to try to get everyone in, but there's a lot. You've sparked a lot of interest here. Alan and Henrietta next on the phone. Hi, Alan, go ahead.
Hey, so I was a gifted kid in school. We moved here somewhat recently, and I have a current third grader who in our previous district was identified as a gifted kid, and then I've got a first grader who you know, she was there before the universal screening that they had. So don't know if she will be identified, because I don't think they do that in Rush Henrietta, although there are things we're learning about there all the time. Anyway, so I come to it from those perspectives. But Evan, something that you mentioned at the top, you may have been quoting someone else, was that we've got big problems in society that we need to solve. And from where I've sort of seen things lately, most of the challenges that we have are not really asking for a technocratic solution, but more in the vein of how can we make sure that we're including everyone in what we're doing, and that we're keeping people in mind who may be different from us. And so I think that comes to bear in this conversation. I think Dr. Plucker has done a really interesting job of highlighting how that tension plays out currently and has in the past. I certainly don't have any prescriptions for things. I thought about being a teacher at one point and then realized it would probably be too hard for me. So I went other ways career wise.
The problems that need to be solved are less academic, more social, more. I'm trying to make sure I can crystallize the concern you have here, Alan.
Sure. So what I heard from you was, and again, you may have been quoting, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but
I think I stole this from Nina, but go ahead.
Okay. We need really smart people to be pushed to the limits of their academic abilities so that we can figure out how to go farther into space.
Solve big problems.
Figure out how to cure cancer. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's some space for that, but I think what we need a lot more than, let's say, the next Elon Musk, who is often put up as one of those geniuses, although he's bought a lot of his companies rather than started them from scratch, is we need someone who's sort of the anti-Elon, who is not trying to railroad over certain populations under whatever he's talking about these days, but someone who is saying, how can we make sure that the stuff that we're doing, we're not trying to tinker to create better bombs, but we're trying to make sure that we build a world where we don't want to bomb people.
I got you there, Alan. Yeah, so thank you very much for the phone call. And I think I understand your concern and your point much better. I'm going to dodge the idea of turning this into an Elon Musk referendum, but I will say this. Your point is an important one, because the problems of the current world and the future world are not just academic. The question of what we do with our abilities is a big one. It goes to AI, it goes to climate change, it goes to prospects of nuclear war, it goes to resource allocation. And you're correct, it can't just be solved in a classroom. So I want to give Dr. Plucker some time to talk about whether you think gifted education can tackle sort of the holistic approach to big problems, if that makes sense, Dr. Plucker.
I would argue, I guess, that this is a very important topic that Alan raises. I think that teaching about ethical decision-making, ethical use of creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship is something we don't do enough at any level of education, including higher education. I think the Great Recession is a fantastic example of this, of people designing financial instruments that they knew could implode and just thought, well, it's going to be somebody else's problem until it became everybody's problem. And I would argue we're still paying for those mistakes today, right? So, but at the same time, I still see amazing K-12 university students like using their creativity, using their advanced skills to try to find the cure for cancer all the time. And I think we tend to focus on these sort of creative superstars, like one who's been mentioned, forgetting that he has tens of thousands of incredibly talented people who were doing the work and aren't on Twitter or whatever it's called now, every single day dropping bombs on people. They're just trying to make the world a better place. So we can do a better job teaching it, but this is still a very good point to keep in mind.
And let me just follow that with a question that I think is central and I think demands an answer if we're going to understand why Dr. Plucker thinks it's a problem. Listeners heard Nina describe earlier what you saw as the growing consequence for your child who was not pushed, which was you had a very very smart child who was starting to hate and loathe school, dread school, as opposed to seeing it as an awesome place to go to continue learning and thriving. And thankfully you intervened and sounds like things are much better. But the consequence could have been probably a number of different paths. Could have been someone who didn't like school at all, didn't do well later in life, in school settings, in test settings, in academic settings, in creative settings, because you didn't get to flex those muscles earlier. So that would have been, you know, a consequence for Nina's child, if that's a fair concern. Is that a good description?
Those were among some of our many concerns, okay, too.
many concerns. So Dr. Plucker, on the whole, if we don't do better as a society with this population of students that you identify as larger than a lot of schools think and isn't getting challenged and isn't thriving in the way they can, what are the consequences for society?
I think that the economic consequences are fairly obvious, but I think we often downplay sort of the cultural consequences. One of this country's strongest attributes is our soft power, and a lot of our soft power is cultural. Movies, TV shows, books, popular entertainment, diplomacy, political might, and things like that. Those are all skills where we need people with advanced skills in those areas. And there is always this is actually advice that my father gave me many, many, many years ago. I was thinking about going into a certain field and I was like, I'm just not sure that the job market's good. And he got really short with me and said, there's always a shortage of talented people in every single field. People who will go in, work hard, and have those skills. And I have found that largely to be true. And we need more talent. This country has an amazing thirst for talent. But at the same time, Evan, I have always said, this is a great country in which to be talented. It's not a great country in which to develop your talents. How can we help students get to that starting line so it's not just upper middle class families that have that advantage? I want every child to have that advantage.
Tristan in Rochester next on the phone. Hey, Tristan, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So I was in the 80s, one of those gifted kids. I went to Montessori. I skipped third grade, transferred to the public system here in Rochester, went to school without walls. So I had all of those advantages, you could say, in terms of what was available to me. There were times when I was ignored. There were times when I was challenged. But here's the general problem, because I got to say, all of that intervening, it kind of helped, but not a lot. And here's why. The motif of the experience was, oh, they'll figure it out. And I didn't. Because despite the talent, despite the self-starting, despite the craving of knowledge, I still couldn't figure it out, whatever it is. And now I drive for Uber, and I'm 47 and finally about to go to grad school. And I could have cut 20 years off that process if some of this had been developed more, some of these programs.
Tristan, I appreciate the call. Dr. Plucker, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think that Tristan makes a very good point here, is that there still is this stereotype that, you know what, we're not doing a great job with bright students, advanced students, but that's okay because they will figure it out. I don't know how many studies we have to do that show that that is absolutely not the case. Especially lower income families, again, social capital really, really matters in this country. And even things like college counseling for advanced learners, it is a different beast sometimes, and you need help. Now, I thought that when my two were going off to college that, hey, I'm a college professor. I've done this for years. I can totally help them. I did not know how much of a game this was and you need specialized knowledge to be able to get into really good colleges. So we had to go out and hire somebody. And if you had told me that before we did it, I would have said, you're crazy. I can do that. People can't do these things on their own. Being successful in life and developing your talents shouldn't be a matter of luck. And right now it really, really is. And we just need to take this much more seriously.
Tristan, first of all, I appreciate the phone call and I feel for you. I wish you well. And your phone call is kind of a rejoinder to my idea that I expressed earlier this hour that, you know, schools are naturally focused on kids who are struggling almost exclusively, and kids who are super excellers, you know, it's easy to think that they'll figure it out. Or they might be not challenged now, but that's all right. Like, they're smart and they're going to be fine and they'll figure it out and their families will help them. So I really take that point, and I really wish you well. Thank you. And maybe along those lines, David, listening in Vancouver, Canada, on the WXXI mobile app, he says, in the eighth grade, I was tested twice for IQ because my first score was very high. The second test confirmed the results of the first. Nothing was done about it, in my case in large measure, because my mother did not want her kids skipping grades. She had skipped three grades as a child and found it socially stigmatizing. By 10th grade, I was extremely bored but still at the top of my class. By 11th grade, I'd basically stopped going to school. It wasn't for a few years yet, when I was 21, that I found a passion in learning about molecular biology. I likely couldn't have done much about it, though, were it not for the fact that one of my uncles was a professor at the University of Michigan. Having floundered for so many years, it took a letter for him to get me admitted. I ended up being a professor in the field, but I'm sure that many, many like me, end up not having the chance to live up to their potentials. It's David in Vancouver.
I mean, I wish David's story was unique. I think he's right. I think it's a very, very common story. It, none of us wants to go hang out somewhere for 12 years where we're not going to be challenged and where we're going to be bored. There's just no way that that's good for kids. And yet we've kind of accepted that here. And, if you can figure it out, if your family can figure it out, good for you. Otherwise, tough luck. And, there's a better way to do it, especially now that, we would not automatically go to something like grade skipping anymore. We would look at...
Does that happen not very often anymore?
I mean, it still happens. It's never been very common.
Okay. Skipping three, like his mother,
three,
is a lot.
That's
tough.
That's considered radical.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are some third graders working at a ninth grade level that it's really hard to meet their needs. I absolutely acknowledge that. Sometimes you do need those radical steps.
I'm going to squeeze in one more email, and then I'm going to ask Nina and Dr. Plucker what they want states like New York to do, maybe vis-a-vis what other states are doing or not doing. David says, great discussion about a complex issue. Let's define talent as getting more benefit for each unit of work in any specific endeavor. Then we need to acknowledge that some individuals have more academic talent, just as some individuals have more athletic, art, or musical talent than others. A child with only average physical talent will hit a ceiling of maximum benefit, regardless of how much the parents spend on camps, equipment, etc. Those with high levels of physical talent have a much higher ceiling and would benefit from the same investments. Similarly, there are plenty of kids with average academic talent who can only achieve so much in an academic sense, regardless of how much enrichment they receive. I think the real goal should be to identify those children from all backgrounds who display academic talent early and offer them appropriate enrichment. This doesn't mean that we don't offer appropriate instruction and opportunities to all other students. Finally, it's important to note that much of a person's career and professional success also depends upon work ethic. I've encountered a number of lazy geniuses who will never hit their ceiling, as well as kids with average talent who are motivated and organized and have high work ethics who overachieve in their careers. That's from Dave in Rochester. What do you think, Dr. Plucker?
I don't disagree in principle with any of that. I think that makes a lot of sense. I like a lot of the phrasing there. At the same time, I mean, I've had this effort versus talent argument with people for decades. And in the end, from a societal perspective, I don't think it matters whether you're talented or whether you're a hard worker and less talented. In the end, what matters is what you can do, and from your personal perspective, how that allows you to be fulfilled and take care of your family, et cetera. And from a societal perspective, how that allows you to contribute in. If you're slightly less, you know, if person A is super talented, doesn't work as hard, person B is less talented but works their tailbones off, and they kind of produce about the same level of excellent performance, I don't care who's more talented, right?
Well, let me close with this here. In Nina's original outreach, you mentioned that only 8 states have no mandate for schools to identify these, I mean, again, if we don't prefer the term gifted, and that I think our guests agree, and maybe there's better terminology, I'm using that because it is well known, and it could change. But there are 8 states that don't have a mandate for schools to identify these kids in an academic setting. New York State's one of those 8 states, Nina, right?
Yes.
And so what do you want to see change?
I would love to see New York State have legislation where these students will be, its schools will be required to identify them, and then there will be some funds available to hire and train advanced learner specialists to work with these students and really help give them, I think, the attention that they need to be successful, to have good self-esteem, to feel great about who they are, and to be the best student and the best citizen in our community down the road that they can be. So I think, having the state involved at that level would make a huge difference. I don't think a lot of people realize that New York State lags behind most of the rest of the country on this issue, but I think many other states are doing interesting things. Dr. Plucker has tremendous information on that. So there's many other state initiatives that we can easily model ours after.
Are you aware of any legislation that would put New York in this category?
I know that there was one recently that would require all school districts in the state of New York to test for high ability students. I'm not sure where that stands right now.
That's one for us to make some calls on.
I think it was somewhat of a long shot. I know there's many bills on the floor. Gotcha. I have not heard that, it's passed with flying colors, but I was delighted that
The fact that we're hearing the music means we've hit the end. And if I didn't get your email, you're probably going to have to go see Dr. Plucker tonight. Where can you do it, Nina?
At Cockins Road Middle School, 4 o'clock for teachers and 7 o'clock for parents.
7 o'clock for parents tonight, Cockins Road Middle School. Mm-hmm. Nina, thank you for sharing your family story and for helping to push us have this conversation. The emails that I didn't even get to are also fascinating. I encourage anyone who sent them, go visit tonight because there's a lot of interest on the subject. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Jonathan Plucker from Johns Hopkins, you can find his books, author of a number of books, and one of the foremost experts in this subject. Thank you for making time for us today.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.